Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, celebrate the 100th anniversary of T.S. Eliot's iconic poem, The Wasteland, with scholar and professor Jed Rasula, author of What the Thunder Said, How the Wasteland Made Poetry Modern. Rasula discusses his book and the enduring impact of The Wasteland with poet and scholar Reginald Gibbons. The following conversation originally took place December 6th, 2022, and was recorded live via Zoom.
Hello, welcome to this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director for the AWM. Thank you all for being here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight's program marks the 100th anniversary of the beginning of modern poetry with the publication of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. As author and professor Jed Rasula argues in his new book, What the Thunder Said, its publication was a watershed, marking a before and after. Here to discuss that book and the poem that inspired it, Dr. Rasula is the Helen S. Lanier Distinguished Professor at the University of Georgia. He's the author of 9 scholarly books and 3 poetry collections, and the co-editor of 2 anthologies. His recent books include Destruction Was My Beatrice, Dada and the Unmaking of the 20th Century, and History of a Shiver, The Sublime Impudence of Modernism. We're going to welcome him here. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, it's nice to be here.
So I wanted to start by asking you, first of all, congratulations on the book's publication. It's out today. And I wanted to start by asking you if you would be willing to read a passage or two for us.
Sure. I think the easiest way to get us started is just with a couple paragraphs from the introduction of the book. By the time T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, entered public domain in the United States in 1998, it had been a staple of higher education for half a century. No teaching anthology could afford to omit it, because Eliot succeeded in making the case that modern poetry had to be difficult. The Wasteland served as the paradigm of difficulty. More recently, it has settled into a role as modernist icon, as every passing year brings a new round of centenaries commemorating modernism. Long canonized, Eliot's poem has acquired the demeanor of a scenic viewpoint with its Park Service plaque and swivel-mounted telescope. I should pluralize that to telescopes in the case of The Wasteland. Eliot's eminence as preeminent among poets is not what it used to be. Yet because Eliot is no longer contemporary, his work is unencumbered by the reception accorded it upon publication. And after a century of collage, of Dada, and surrealism, its disjunctive surface is less alarming, certainly to contemporary consumers of media in any form that we now have available. If it initially seemed a response to the late Great War, in its centennial year, this year, the poem's themes of drought and drabness sound immediate and foreboding to a younger generation facing climate disaster and the moral bankruptcy of the political class. The poem, straddling past and future, applies pressure on the present. So it's time to consider that in the centenary of its publication, The Wasteland merits recognition not as a poem, there's a mountain of scholarship on that, but as a phenomenon. Eliot's poem is a component in a broader cultural revolution that led to abstraction in art, atonality in music, and an overall flouting of conventions by the international avant-gardes. The Wasteland partakes of collage as compositional principle in the arts, and it shares with Marcel Duchamp and others the notion that modernism convened a space in which every artwork could be a conceptual gambit, a wager like a throw of the dice, but in a game for which there's no table and no croupier. After Arthur Rimbaud's adamant exhortation in 1871 that one must be absolutely modern, to the international impact of The Wasteland half a century later, poetry was instrumental in making the modern an ism. But what was it about poetry prompting the thought that it needed to become modern? Was it something about modern life that seemed ripe for poetic treatment? And why poetry? Did poetry possess some symbolic currency unique among the arts? Or was it rather that modernist trends evident in the other arts were felt to be lacking in poetry? Was poetry regressive? Did poetry need a makeover? And why did an art often associated with the adjective timeless feel the need to keep up with the times? So those are the questions that I began to start asking students in seminars a number of years ago that led to the writing of this book.
That was actually going to be my first question for you, was what occasioned, other than the centennial, what occasioned your attraction to The Wasteland as a topic for this book?
Well, my relation to the Wasteland goes back. I recently celebrated my 70th birthday, and I discovered The Wasteland when I was 15. So I have known The Wasteland for the great majority of my life, actually. And I first read The Wasteland in Germany, in Frankfurt, Germany, where I was going to high school in 1968. And Frankfurt at that time was still a city that exhibited the ruins of the Second World War. I remember telling people that I knew, like if you took the trolley from the school I was at into the heart of downtown Frankfurt, if you looked on your left at a certain point, you would see a huge pile of rubble. That would be a ruined cathedral that hadn't been cleared off yet 13 years after the war, and after the war ended. And you could get off at that spot, and then I would give them directions about where else to go. So when I first read The Wasteland in that context, it seemed to me absolutely present, absolutely contemporary. It was not a poem about 1922. It felt to me vividly like a poem of 1968. And other events in 1968 that penetrated that moment of reading The Wasteland were, for instance, a Red Brigade bomb in a department store in downtown Frankfurt, which happened weeks before I bought the Beatles single Hey Jude there at that time. So even the most contemporary events for me, like the Beatles, you know, which I'd been keen on since literally they came to America in early 1964, those things were somehow conveniently wound into the impact of The Wasteland. So The Wasteland just seemed to be a description of the world that I knew at that moment. And when I started reading it, you know, it begins, April is the cruelest month. And then just a couple lines down, it launches into German. And there I was in Frankfurt, Germany. And I thought, oh, this feels natural enough. Well, I'll just keep on with this. So for me, it was probably a very unusual exposure, not one that most people have. It was not an exposure in the classroom. It was not an exposure based on anything other than the fact that I had discovered that Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot were interesting poets and historical figures. And Eliot was only recently dead, and Pound was still alive. And the fact that he was still alive just made me interested in contemporary poetry, which then, you know, occupied much of my time in subsequent decades in editing magazines and writing about living poets. So The Wasteland for me was personal and historical at the same time. And I'm really interested in the extent to which that continues to be the experience for people, or whether I really am personally a relic a relic adherent of a very, very old poem that is moving closer to Tennyson than to, so let's say, the present moment.
You look at, you know, in your book, you look at the origins of the poem itself. So you look at, you know, the environment out of which it came. You look at, you know, what was happening in poetry, both before and after. And you posit that it's such a stark demarcation between what came before and what came after. So how did Eliot make that leap? How did he make that transition?
Well, as the book goes to really great lengths to ponder this, it was absolutely unintentional. Of all of the things that you can say about The Wasteland, the statement that I feel the safest in making and in backing up in every way I can is that The Wasteland was not intended as a game changer. In the historical sense that we now understand it. It was an act of desperate, ambitional striving on the part of a man who was in a marriage that was deeply troubling, who regarded himself as a neurasthenic, which is an outdated, even at the time, an outdated 19th century pre-psychiatric notion that I write about at length in the book. But he thought of himself as a neurasthenic because of the background that he came out of, which was the background of symbolism and Wagnerism and a milieu in which the arts could make people hurt. The arts could lead you into a place where your emotions were just like a not only a psychological ache, but a cosmic ache. That's what symbolism was all about. You know, life is bad for you. Think of the damaged cosmos, you know, and the marvelous kind of paintings from all over the world of symbolist painters that express these kind of things. And Eliot was a recipient of that kind of outlook that something is, you know, something is wrong, not only in the kingdom of Denmark, but in the world, that everything is just going to hell in a handbasket. And especially after 5 years of total war, of the world's first really, you know, quasi-global conflict, his themes concentrated around the motifs of damage and desperation and despondency and despair and lack of, you know, ennui, lack of energy, and ruins and all of that. And in his case, it was personal because he was locked into a marriage that was frustrating, that was producing just great physical and mental ailments on the part of both Eliot himself and his wife. And he was somebody who felt himself to have been rescued as a poet by Ezra Pound when he met him in 1914, just several months before the Great War broke out. And Pound read a draft of an unpublished poem called The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and Pound was stupefied. And because he was an editorial agent for the magazine Poetry, a magazine of verse in Chicago, where you are at this very, very moment. Pound was just really anxious to get this poem into print as soon as possible. And the thing that he wrote to Harriet Monroe, the editor of Poetry, with a sense of astonishment. I mean, every time I reread this letter of Pound's, I feel like if he had the means to have colored the words in his letter, he would have, or using a highlighter, he would have done that. He says, "I've met a young American who modernized himself on his own." And the crucial term there is modernized, because Pound is somebody who went to London as a striving American poet whose head was filled with the gobbledygook of 1890s kind of post-Pre-Raphaelite verse, the kind of stuff that Pound himself later on just called slush. And that was what he thought poetry was. And it took him 5 years of living in London before he encountered Eliot, and then realized that, well, I mean, he'd had inklings of this before he encountered Eliot. You know, he'd started to realize that he himself, Pound, was out of touch with contemporary things. And so he was on the alert for somebody who could do something modern. And at the moment that he became aware of this, he was aware that the most advanced and modern things that he knew of were poems that had been written and published in France 30 and 40 years earlier. So there's nothing to make an aspiring American poet in London, thinking that London is the literary capital of the world, realize that he's living in the olden times and that he got to get out of this stagecoach in a hurry, to suddenly then come upon a fellow American who, you know, has been writing, who has, as he said, made himself modern on his own. But the thing that was crucial here from Eliot's perspective is that Eliot was facing the prospect of becoming a philosophy professor. And, you know, he'd been writing poetry avidly as an undergraduate. The love song of J. Alfred Prufrock was mostly written while he was an undergraduate at Harvard. And then it was finished as a study while he had a study abroad year in Paris. But it was many years old by the time that he met Pound. And yet that's the poem Pound went for. And all I can imagine is, what would it be like today for somebody to be writing poems as an undergraduate, kind of give it up and start on another career, and then have somebody, a major playmaker in the literary world, read your undergraduate poems that you were despairing of anybody ever seeing and responding to, and saying, hey, give this guy a seat at the banquet. And that's pretty much what happened there. And to the end of his life, Eliot was permanently grateful to Pound for having saved his life, basically. You know, that he allowed or engineered it that Eliot could be the poet that he aspired to be, and that by the time he met Pound, had thought that that would be something he'd give up.
That's an incredible story. That's the dream, right? That someone out there is reading your work and is going to pluck you from obscurity.
Yep. And Eliot is definitely the signal instance of that in the 20th century. I can't think of anybody else who's had the kind of impact that Eliot had, who was in similar ways plucked from total obscurity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was the critical reception to the critical, I should say, and the public reception to The Wasteland when it was first published, and how did that initial reception color the influence that it had?
To a considerable extent, I have several chapters in my book about the reception, and the thing that I wanted to do was something that I had not seen really anybody do writing about Eliot, which was to place the poem in a truly international context. Mm-hmm. You know, Eliot is the darling of English departments and English professors. And even though I'm an English professor, I have no degrees in English. So, you know, I it's just kind of an accidental vocation. And so I've always been interested in the way in which The Wasteland is part of a spectrum of responses to or engagements with modernity in the early decades of the 20th century. And a crucial aspect of this is has to do with the background that I spell out in the book of the influence of what became known as Wagnerism. You know, we think of the 20th century as being the early 20th century, at least, is sort of the kingdom of the isms. There are all the isms there. There's futurism, and there's Dada, and there's surrealism, and there's, you know, one after another. They just come pouring out of the mouths of the malcontents from the artistic, you know, avant-garde. And I think that the foundational ism of all isms was Wagnerism, centered around the musical dramas of Richard Wagner. And Wagnerism became a cult. You know, it was a cult now when we look There's nothing really that I would thank Trump for in general, except for reminding us of the fact that there was a Trumpism that preceded Trump, and that was Wagnerism. And I'm not talking about the political spectrum, but the cultural impact. That is something that you were either absolutely for it or absolutely against it. And that was the way Wagnerism appeared in the later decades of the 19th century. And Wagnerism, in terms of how it got to Eliot, it was through symbolism and French symbolism. And all the French symbolist poets were contributors to La Revue Wagnerienne, the Wagnerian Review that was edited by an author who created the stream of consciousness technique that James Joyce later adopted, Edouard Dujardin. And so Eliot was very, you know, aware of French symbolism, and he literally kind of learned his way of behavior as a poet from the work of Jules Laforgue, who was one of those poets. And they were all Wagnerians. They were all people who approached the notion that poetry was a form of, let's say, intense spiritual or cognitive exchange between minds that happened almost supernaturally. So it was no longer a matter of writing a poem that sounded like it might just as easily have been written in prose, you know, no longer writing poems that sounded like op-eds for a newspaper or, you know, theoretical tracts or manifestos or anything like that, but writing poems that were so effusive in a way that you couldn't say what they were about, but you knew that you would experience something. And that's why I think that the closest sense of the kind of poetry that Eliot was inspired by is the kind of thing that Pablo Picasso said in response to a question about what is cubism. And what he said was that cubism was like a perfume. It's in the air, it's in the room, but you don't know where it's coming from. It's just kind of, it's in the air, it's in the environment. And that was the spirit of symbolism that I think Eliot and so many modern poets in other countries and other languages responded to. And that's where the spirit of Wagnerism established something that Eliot became preoccupied with for the rest of his life. And that was what he called the music of poetry. That's the title of an essay, not an essay, a lecture that he gave in Glasgow in 1942, in the midst of the Second World War. And he was puzzling what is the music of poetry? And he recognized the music of poetry has nothing to do with mellifluous attributes borrowed from music, but it had to do with what he identified as a kind of an underlying rhythm, that there was a kind of a template there, a kind of subliminal noise in which something inaudible could be registered in words, in language, to create a mood, an atmosphere. And creating the moods and the atmosphere was more important than conveying a message to him or painting a picture or something like that. And, you know, the more that I thought about this as I was writing the book, I came to a different kind of appreciation of a book by an English graphic novelist named Martin Rowson, who published a book called The Wasteland in several decades ago in the 1980s, which is a treatment of the wasteland storyboarded, as it were, as a gumshoe detective novel along the lines of Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. And that, thinking about Rowson's treatment of the wasteland, made me kind of go back to the original and realize, you know, the whole poem is a storyboard for a film that has never been made and has never needed to be made because it exists as a ciné poème, a term that was invented in Paris in the 1920s without any reference to the wasteland, although it could have been, should have been, if the French had been bilingual. But at any rate, that's very much part of part of a way of answering your question.
Of course. And I just want to let folks know we're going to be joined now by another panelist, who is Reg Gibbons, who's going to join our discussion. Reg is a poet and an author and an editor and a professor of arts and humanities at Northwestern University and a member of the AWM content leadership team. Reg, welcome to the discussion.
Thank you very much.
Of course.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
It's very nice to see you, especially after having read most of your book and being absolutely dazzled by it, really. The chapters in which you not only sketch the Wagnerism, but then follow or map out all of its effects on so many different artists of different sorts is even outdone by the chapters afterward about how people reacted to it, how it changed everyone's sense of what was possible in more than one art. It's just really an astonishing coverage of an entire field of response with so many of the responses so fascinating. The only thing I could add to the response to The Wasteland itself is that when I graduated from high school in 1965, my favorite English teacher gave me the collected poems of T.S. Eliot, and I read The Wasteland for the first time. And it really gave me so much to think about. I was already writing. And then when I left and went to college, immediately took a poetry course, and there was the Wasteland in the middle of it. And I have the book with an amazing number of microscopic, now somewhat faded, pencil annotations as I was drinking in every piece of information about it that I could find. But you really restored for me in this book the awe that I felt long ago, really long ago. I mean, my own careers led me through all kinds of poetry, reading all kinds of poetry in different languages too, but you've restored for me the sheer amazement at reading that poem again. So I thank you.
Oh, sure. Well, I would also want to thank you for having edited for me a really crucial anthology called The Poet's Work sometime in the 70s, which remains, as far as I know, the only thing in English that is a real anthology of poetics by poets from different languages and different poetic traditions. You know, the only equivalent that I really know of is maybe a decade earlier than that, in the late 60s, Hans Magnus Enzensberg, German, you know, the Museum of Poetry, which one includes not just the poetics, but as I recall, actual poems. So it's kind of an anthology in a way. But I'm astonished at this point that we're talking about. Well, let's see. I think your book was published in 1979, which is when my younger daughter was born. She turned 43 next week. So that it's been that long, and there's still nothing in English, you know, like that. Mm. Anyway, that is very much the milieu in which I always experienced The Wasteland, and why I wanted to make a point of presenting some of the earlier translators of The Wasteland. I know of no comparable experience of a major literary work, let alone a poem, but just anything written at all that immediately has translators of the caliber of the scholars and poets that translated The Wasteland. You know, the great German humanist scholar Ernst Robert Curtius, the Italian humanist scholar Mario Praz, Angel Flores and translating into Spanish, and then the future Nobel Prize winning poets like George Seferis in Greek and Czesław Miłosz in Polish. And then, you know, it just goes on and on. I mean, there has been no literary event that has been instantly international in that way. I mean, there are a lot of books that get published and get translated into a lot of languages, and they're, you know, the publishers make a splash out of it and they become news items. But then, you know, 5 years later, people are wondering who's that and, you know, has anybody read it? The Wasteland is different.
It is. And our times are different, and nothing will last more than 5 years again, I think. But yeah. I also want to add one other thing, which is, in addition to all those brilliant translators, and it was fascinating to see how many you had found and how many you listed and even quote them, the Spanish poet Luis Cernuda in Castilian Spanish, who was born in 02, died in 63, was the poet who superseded Lorca as the greatest influence within Spanish poetry in the mid-20th century. And that was partly because he was the only great poet in Spain who read Eliot and who read Yeats. And he was the one who absorbed not just the music of the Wasteland, but he saw in the Wasteland that it was not only permissible and not only interesting, but necessary to sort of image the underside of daily life and the hardships and the frustrations. And I mean, the young clerk Carbuncular and those scenes, that was right up Cernuda's, you know, alley. He sees that and then wrote poems about Spain, which had that kind of sandpaper realism, you know.
Right.
And I happened to read him because in graduate school, I went to Spain on a Fulbright, and one of my former professors as an undergrad had said, "Why don't you translate Cernuda?" And I did. I ended up, that was my first book. And it was through Cernuda that I learned more about Eliot in a way, poetically. It was just, it's really interesting.
I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I when I started studying Spanish in 1973 or 74, I came across Cernuda, and this is before your translations. So there really weren't any translations that I had. I remember hours and hours laboring over an attempted translation at a very premature knowledge of Spanish that I had at the time of his Ode to a Graveyard or something like that. At least that's what I'm remembering.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things that kept me going, because until you talked about him just now, I had not realized how much I had been prepared by Eliot to respond affirmatively to this particular Spanish poet, because I was certainly looking at other people in Spanish who were easier to read, but didn't have the same interest in trying to translate them.
Well, Cernuda was a sort of Eliotic counterweight to Lorca and Alberti, who was a very festive poet, and to Jorge Guillén, who was very intellectual, but not Eliotic, you know.
Yeah.
So it was, I loved reading, I loved encountering everything I found in your book.
Yeah, the thing that really, you know, that has compelled my attention for many, many years, and that I was really delighted in the opportunity in writing this book to dig deeper into it, is this sense of why the Wasteland was so instantaneously translatable.
Yes.
And you know, I give examples in the book, it's actually very accessibly translatable English through much of it. So, you know, because he's writing in what Eliot himself later called a music of imagery. He recognized that it wasn't about making or following certain sound or metrical patterns. It was about the ability to kind of instantaneously create a scenario in the mind that could be sustained for a little bit, but not very long. And then the question is what you do with it. Mm-hmm. And I want to read an example here. This is from the last section of the poem, What the Thunder Said, from which the title of my book derives. This is after the list of cities that are collapsing. And then suddenly you go from Athens and Alexandria and these cities that are cities of doom, to these lines. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings, and bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward down a blackened wall. I mean, that sends chills through me every time I read it, as it has for, you know, more than 50 years now. And the astonishing thing, looking at the drafts and manuscripts of The Wasteland, is that he wrote it out in longhand straight away. The only change in that entire passage is in the last line, where he substituted and crawled head downward, where he had written something else like creatures. And then I think he realized, well, the bats are already there in the poem. You just continue with the bats.
I want to mention one other thing that really dazzled me. In fact, it unlocked something for me. Reading the Wagner Nietzsche stuff and carrying on with that later, and as it continued to sort of pop up in the book, I realized that your book had shown me for the first time that the idea of poetry as music was it may be the thing that I always thought it was, that is part of it. But what you did with that idea made me think, okay, now I understand not just more about Wagner, because Wagner's always, I mean, Wagner never stops. The music just keeps going, and it has moods that change. And it's the mood, it's the change of the mood in Wagner or in Mahler, even in Bruckner sometimes, but he gets in ruts, you know, and stays there for a while.
Yes, you can hear the 18th century axle wheels squeaking as they churn through the mud.
But when I thought about Mahler and I thought about the wasteland as you described it and presented it, then I realized that the music, that there's more than one kind of music in poetry. Of course, there's the linguistic phonemic stuff. And by the way, I went all the way through the poem again, and I marked every line that is metrical, because he plays with it all the time. He'll go four or five lines that are perfectly iambic, although they sound, as one of your witnesses, so to speak, said, they sound as if they were prose, but they actually scan. But there was this other thing about how when Mahler shifts a mood, that's the shift. Those are the shifts that Eliot's making. He's making musical mood shifts.
Yeah.
And then that really opened up a lot for me as I thought about the poem again.
Yeah, I mean, some aspects of that kind of led me along, because I've written a lot about this in an earlier book called A History of Shiver, The Sublime Impudence of Modernism, that came out, I think, in 2017, which is more about Wagnerism and musicality and so forth. But that book was much more concerned with the phenomenon of what was called at the time melomania, or a kind of the frenzy about music. It was the spirit of Wagnerism in the day. Everybody, whether they were Wagnerites or not, if they were not Wagnerites, they were Brahmsians or Beethovians or something else, Scriabinites. It was all about music. And, you know, Walter Pater in 1877 famously noted that all of the present arts were aspiring to the condition of music. Mm. But what Wagner added, I think, and you just touched on, Wagner revolted against the operatic traditions, which were really social conventions more than anything else, whereby an opera composer, you know, just wrote music through interludes from one aria to the next, and that the real music was in the arias. And then meanwhile, there's just a kind of musical noodling that carried. And that was the point at which people in the boxes and all over would just start chatting to each other, because they knew, okay, nobody's going to be singing an aria here, so now the music is just carrying us along. And Wagner was incensed by that, and he decided, nope, if people are going to come to my operas, and they're going to last for 4 or 5 days, by the way, you're going to pay attention every single moment. You know, you don't get to chat with your neighbors. That's not what music is for. And, that then translated into whether it came directly from Wagnerism or not, I think a 20th century trend in all of the arts, which is there's no filler, which is to say there are no cribs, there are no prefabrications of what a poem, a piece of music, an artwork should be. Everyone starts from scratch. Mm. It makes its own melody, it makes its own method, it makes its own goal and destination and roots from the moment that it convenes itself. And then, as I wrote about in History of a Shiver, this is a concept that's actually directly traceable to the German Romantics of 1798 and 1800 in the Ateneum, in the Jena circle, that about which several books have just, interesting books have just appeared this year. Mm. But I think that's the kind of thing that enabled someone like Eliot to write a poem like The Wasteland with Ezra Pound's help, which is that once you decide that everything counts and there's no filler, it means mm-hmm. that you have to figure out how what you have is going to fit together. Because, and this is where collage, I think, became a solution for him.
Yeah.
And through the kind of Pound's notion or application of leitmotifs, historical transcendental moments in the cantos that he'd been working with for a couple of years before the waste, before he worked as an amanuensis on The Wasteland for Eliot. And that is the principle that discrepant parts in a work of art can coexist. You don't have to provide transitions. All you have to do is to create a structure where people can confidently move from one to another and feel like they're getting it. Mm. And this was, I think, something that coincided remarkably well and effectively with the rise of cinema. Because cinema was a new art medium, an absolutely new one that had no precedent. So everyone, the first viewers and the first makers, all had to figure out what they were seeing and how to make it work as an aesthetic experience.
Yes.
And that, I think, was very much reinforced the sense that Eliot had and Pound had that we already have modern art. You know, it's called the cinema. Mm-hmm. So poetry should be a modern art, too.
Well, when you introduced the idea of the collage and carried that on for quite a while, I was waiting with bated breath for you to get to montage. Because I was thinking, wait a minute, 1920s, this is Eisenstein, this is jump cuts, that's the other way of looking at The Wasteland. They're jump cuts, not just they're musical mood shifts, and they are cinematic jump cuts, and it's the thrill of the jump once you appreciate montage that makes it so exciting.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad you brought up Eisenstein and montage, because if you read his, he was a voluminous writer, and there's a tremendous amount of interesting mm-hmm. stuff. But there's a very late book of his called Non-Indifferent Nature, in which almost the entire thing is about literature, and in which he very explicitly maps his own cinematic solutions to various cinematic problems to things in literature, although it's not necessarily the things you'd think. And so where he identifies the principle of montage in literary terms is not T.S. Eliot. I don't know that he ever encountered Eliot at all, but Paradise Lost. And it's because he's looking at the kind of enjambment that Milton produced.
It's very cinematic. Yeah, it's very cinematic. When the devil leaps over the wall into Eden, you know, it's like a clip from a film. It's amazing.
Yep. Yeah, and the only thing that you could say that's non-cinematic maybe about Paradise Lost is that you can just kind of hear the gears rolling in the machine as it's moving the events forward in a sprocketed manner, to use the cinematic terminology. But yes, Eisenstein recognized that poets had long prefigured cinematic possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Even Pindar was upbraided by the Roman poets, the Latin poets, because he kept jumping off into funny angles that didn't make sense. Yeah. But yeah, having studied him, Pindar, I mean, I think that that's the earliest example I know of, you can call it collage, you can call it montage, you can call it the jump cut, you could call it the musical shift, but the poetic powers of association just invite that, you know?
Yeah. And I was talking a little bit about this, I think before you came on, I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it was before you came on, about in the book, I pay a little bit of attention to this interesting German writer, Karl Einstein, who was a lived in Paris during the 1920s. And he talked about cubist space, that is the effect of cubism. And he identified something in an almost geometric sense as cubist space, in which, as he put it, there can be a gradual modification of sensations. And I found that personally a really revelatory exposure to what it is about The Wasteland that really gets to people. In other words, if you read The Wasteland and stick with it and become a reader of The Wasteland rather than a casual consumer or anything, what you discover is that you are learning how to modulate your personal sensorium, your sense of how things, discrepant moments and tendencies can fit together. And we do that all the time when we're out in the city, out in the country, anywhere you're walking around, you're assimilating a diversity of information from various parts. And your assimilation is what enables you to keep from freaking out at any given moment, just recognizing that it's a total integrated world around you, and you can recognize a lot of it, but you can't recognize all of it. And so you have a developed relationship to assimilation. There are a lot of things that we perceive happening around us we don't understand immediately, but we don't freak out. We just recognize, well, okay, that's interesting. And that point of orientation could be extended to an aesthetic object, whether a piece of music or a painting, a cubist painting or something, was a real revelation and a kind of order of business in the arts in the early 20th century.
Well, thank you both for this incredible, illuminating discussion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast, our final new episode of 2022. Next week, we'll revisit our favorite moments of the past year from our top 10 streamed episodes. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.